welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we do have a website for the show, which you can find at radioinvivo.net. You can access all of our past programs on the website. And after a year and a half of doing the show, there's quite a bit of material there, with more coming all the time on the wide variety of topics we've featured here on Radio In Vivo, so we hope you'll check that out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and you'll get right to the podcast. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well, at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology, by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to explore the fascinating world of parapsychology and extrasensory perception. Longtime Triangle residents will know this, but newcomers may be surprised to learn that for many decades, Durham has been known as perhaps the foremost site in the world for the scientific study of parapsychology, thanks to the pioneering work of Drs. Jacob B. and Louisa E. Rhine, who originally came to Duke University in 1927. In 1962, they established an independent foundation to sponsor and continue their work, which continues to thrive today in the form of the Rhine Research Center. The Rhine Research Center is now housed in a dedicated building near Duke and continues to conduct scientific investigation into ESP and parapsychology. And with a broadened mission, which we will hear all about shortly, the center has just changed its name to the Rhine Center, an institute for consciousness research and education. My guests today are two of the central figures at the Rhine Center, Drs. Sally Rhine Feather Hendrickson, who is acting director at the center, and Dr. Larry Burke, who is a private practice radiologist and is president of the board of directors at the center. Now, you may have noticed a couple of interesting things when I just gave you Sally's name. The Hendrickson derives from the fact that Sally is married to WCOM's own Bill Hendrickson, who hosts the interview show called Time Out on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here at the station. And the Rhine surname, of course, stems from the fact that Sally is the daughter of Jacob and Louisa Rhine. She is a clinical psychologist and a parapsychologist with a PhD from Duke. She is also the co-author of a lay-oriented book about the ESP experiences of ordinary people called The Gift, which was published in 2005 by St. Martin's Press. Larry Burke, as I just mentioned, is president of the board of directors at the Rhine Center. He has a BA from Duke and completed medical school and radiology training at the University of Pittsburgh. He was on the faculty at Duke University Medical Center until 2004. While at Duke, he was director of education at the Duke Center for Integrative Medicine and co-founded the Mind-Body Medicine Study Group at Duke University Medical Center. Since 2004, Larry has led his own consulting company called Healing Images Incorporated, which specializes in musculoskeletal teleradiology and emotional freedom techniques. Sally and Larry, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Hello. Thank you for being here, for inviting us.
Thanks for the invitation, Ernie.
It's my pleasure. Sally, I would like to start with you. You have spent much of your life immersed in the pursuit of scientific investigation of ESP and other paranormal phenomena. Could you fill us in a little bit more than I did in the introduction about the history of your parents' work and the history of the Rhine Center itself?
Good. Yeah, I will be happy to do that. The reason we're in Durham, North Carolina, and also today here in Carrboro, is because my parents came down here from the north many, many years ago, back in the early 30s, because of one man at Duke University, the first chairman of the Department of Psychology, William McDougall, was open-minded toward the possibility that one could study things like the paranormal in a university setting. In other words, they could become scientific.
Sure.
Up to that point, they really weren't. And because of that openness, they began a collaboration there, which led to testing of Duke students. And because the results were very positive, they continued. And that was how it happened to come and be here now. That was the founding of it.
I see. And then here it is to this day.
Yeah. Because things worked then and worked quite well, and then they continued with the research, which is basically, we are basically a research organization plus education.
I see. Did your parents find it difficult to conduct this work in the face of what I'm sure must have been ongoing skepticism from the established scientific community, which of course survives to this day as well?
Yes, that was true then and is true now. Actually, they took on a topic which had a pretty bad reputation at the time. There was a lot of fraudulent material going on in the seances of the mediums of the day. And they themselves had uncovered some fraud and wondered if there was anything substantial, factual, to this age-old belief that man can communicate by telepathy and such. And so, to begin with, it was difficult. Then, as soon as they got results and published them, they were quite surprised to find that even though the results in the scientific work was done quite well for its time, that even so, regardless how well it was done, it still was not going to be accepted. And that's still the many, many years later, 70 years later, we're still struggling with, no matter how good the research and how well it's published and reduplicated elsewhere, there's still the criticism that something's wrong because it just can't be.
Right, right. And I want to talk more about that a little bit later on. But still getting a little bit more of the background, Sally, you spent many years in private practice as a clinical psychologist after having worked with your parents for a number of years as well. And I understand that you returned to this type of work about 10 years ago. What drew you back into the world of parapsychology?
Well, actually, Bill and I returned to North Carolina for our retirement years to do the things that people are supposed to do in retirement, you know, play tennis, garden.
Uh-huh. And I've been to your home, and it is quite a beautiful garden you've got there.
Well, we got sucked into the Rhine Center because they were having difficulties, and rather than see this work just disappear because of lack of funding, we got involved just to help out for a little bit as volunteers, and here it is over 12 years since that day, and mm-hmm. we're very heavily involved, and in fact, we now see that the Ryan Center is going to survive with people like Larry Burke and other younger people taking over for what us older people were doing at one time.
So the torch is being passed.
Absolutely.
Well, that's great. Well, Larry, what about you? You're a radiologist, and as such, you're certainly trained in a very highly evidence-driven field. What led you to become involved in the Ryan Center and the pursuit of mind-body connection work?
Well, when I came here as a Duke undergraduate, it had been my intention in 1973 to sign up for a parapsychology course and be a psychology major, and unfortunately, I discovered that Dr. Ryan had moved off campus 10 years before, and Duke no longer offered any sort of parapsychological studies.
I see.
And so I basically went on and pursued my medical career. And when I moved back to Durham in 1993, 20 years later, the Ryan Center was the first place I went, because I figured I had missed out on something when I was here as an undergrad, because I never even went to visit the off-campus institute. So. And then I think the most amazing thing to me was when I discovered that the quality of the research was so high, because I'd spent 10 years doing radiology research, doing what I thought was, you know, rigorous scientific work.
Sure.
And then discovered that most of what passes for research in the medical field would never pass the standards in parapsychology. There's actually almost no comparison.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
In that.
How so?
Well, if I did a study and it achieved a statistical significance of p less than 0.05, meaning that less than 5% chance that the results were due to chance.
Sure.
1 out of 20. That was acceptable and considered meeting the scientific standards.
Right.
And I think you won't find you'll find almost no parapsychological studies that meet such a low level of evidence. So most of them are p.000001. You know, so the chances are 1 in 1,000,000 that the results are due to random chance. So I was impressed that the statistical evidence was much higher in parapsychology than any other field of science I'd ever seen, and I think few people actually realize that.
Absolutely, and that's another aspect I would definitely like to hear more about, and I've got some questions prepared to lead us there. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to kind of lay a little bit more of the groundwork first. I think anybody listening to us would probably have a pretty good idea of what we're talking about here. We all know what ESP is, I think. But I'd still like to get your working definitions of the phenomenon and of the other paranormal phenomena upon which you conduct research. Either one of you.
Okay, well, I'll start off.
Okay.
We realize at the beginning that our language is inadequate, but we have to use what we've got.
Right.
So even the term extrasensory perception implies that somehow there's a perceiving of something happening without the use of the senses. Well, we are sure about without the use of the senses, but we don't know if this is a perception or a knowing or what. But so that's one term. Extrasensory perception is one of the major phenomena, and that can be looked at in terms of telepathy, that is knowing between two people, reading someone's mind. That's the one the public generally thinks of as the most common.
Mm-hmm.
Second one would be clairvoyance, where no other person necessarily is involved, but knowing a scene, something's happening at a distance. It's called remote viewing now, since the government work took on that name, the same thing, really. And then the other major ESP type of phenomena is precognition, that's knowing of the future. That was discovered only later, after my dad had and his team had established the other two phenomena in the laboratory. And then they began to think, well, you know, if it can occur, if somebody can know over space something that's happening 100 miles from now, maybe time is not a factor either. And lo and behold, time was not a factor. You can predict an order of cards or something, what are pictures that are going to be shown tomorrow and ahead of time. And that is that phenomena is also very common in public experiences, too, private spontaneous experiences that people have knowing of the future. The other major phenomena, we call it psychokinesis, mind energy, mind over matter. Again, we don't know exactly what it is, some sort of energy that's not identified yet, or effect, maybe not even energy, information where one can have an effect on a moving object, biological, inanimate, animate, of that sort of thing. And those are the basic phenomena. They can be studied in various ways.
I see. Well, I wanted to ask you about 10 or 12 years ago when one of my daughters was in middle school. She did a project about ESP research, and she and her sister actually visited the center and took the tests with the cards. And I'm sorry to say I don't remember the results, but I bring that up because I understand that the methodologies used to explore ESP have changed considerably since then. What types of tests do you conduct today, and to what end?
Well, card guessing got to be boring, particularly in the modern era when there's so much else to do. And so what I used to enjoy as a child, taking my friends up to the lab and doing card tests, is pretty dull today. So that has been superseded by a number of methods. Probably the most popular one now is called the Ganzfeld. Larry, I know that's one. It's one that you like a lot. Do you want to describe that?
What is that?
Ganzfeld, basically German translates as clear field, and that you want to create a sense of sensory deprivation that might allow people to tune in more to their subtle extrasensory perceptions. And generally you have two experimental rooms that are soundproof. And in one room there's a transmitter, someone sending a message to the other person, the receiver, in another room. And the message is usually that they're watching a dramatic video clip that's showing on a TV screen, and so the transmitter is watching that vivid clip and, you know, being enrolled in all the vivid images. And the receiver then is in a state of sensory deprivation, which is achieved by putting headphones with pink noise into both ears, so you're not really not getting any meaningful auditory input. And then you put ping pong balls that are cut in half over the one over each eye, and then shine a red light, which gives you kind of pink noise in the visual perception as well. So then, basically, the subject's left with a stream of images that they're presumably their own subconscious is generating, and the goal of the experiment is for them to attempt to figure out, be open to whatever the transmitter is sending about the video clip they're watching, and so they would record a stream of consciousness, a verbal report of what they're experiencing. And then after a period of time, the experimental sessions ended, and then the receiver would be shown four different video clips, one of which was the clip that the transmitter was actually watching, and that would give them a 1 out of 4 chance of guessing the correct clip.
Sure.
And it turns out that the average student that got recruited from Duke and average subjects would get about 34%, right, which is 1 out of 3 instead of 1 out of 4, which is, and after many, many trials, this achieved, you know, fantastic statistical significance, such that most people believe that this is the most robust evidence for parapsychology. And then in a couple isolated examples, they've done research with gifted subjects, such as going to the Juilliard School and testing those students and discovering that they would get 50% right instead of just a third. And if they isolated the musicians alone, they would get 75%. Now, seemingly giving some validation to the idea that musicians are able to, playing in an ensemble, are able to tune in to other members of the group, and they have enhanced right brain abilities. So.
Sure, sure. Well, those are pretty remarkable numbers. Yeah. Yeah.
That correlation with creativity has been replicated in many, many research, and also in the anecdotal reports that people send in. Very often, the people who seem to be psychic more than others are people who, in ordinary life, you'll find are creative, artistic, in some way.
Mm-hmm. And does that lead you to any hypotheses?
Well, mm-hmm. people talk about having a sensitive temporal lobe. You know, one of the questions that's been around since the days of William James, who was the mentor to McDougall, who was Rhine's mentor, sort of a chain of events from Harvard to Duke. And I think it was.
And Duke is always happy about that kind of change.
Yeah, sure, right. Sure. And I think it was James who first proposed, you know, the dilemma of consciousness as to whether the brain was the generator of consciousness, or whether it was a transceiver of consciousness, whether the brain was just able to tune in to other dimensions, or whether all the dimensions were contained in the lump of 3 pounds of meat that's inside of the skull. So, thinking that creative people might have, for some reason, more temporal lobe sensitivity and be able to tune into images more efficiently than other people, although presumably everybody's got a temporal lobe, so...
We hope so.
We hope so. Everyone would have this capability then. So.
It may be a sort of a boundary thing, like they're more open and less... And in fact, that's what the more psychological explanation would be, that they're more permeable boundaries, and therefore they don't inhibit and shut down on information coming in that the rest of us more left-brain people tend to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Sally, in your book... You quote a Gallup poll conducted in 2001 that showed that half of all Americans believe ESP is real, and that 65 million Americans report that they have personally experienced ESP. You also say, and I quote, "Skeptics still try to dismiss ESP, but the scientific evidence is substantial and continually growing," end quote. Could you give us a little bit more detail on that? I know you've touched on a little bit, but what is the amount of scientific evidence that ESP is, in fact, a real phenomenon?
Right. It's summarized best in specifics in a book I mentioned to you off the radio, by Entangled Minds by Dean Radin. If anyone is really interested in the science, that would be a quick summary rather than going to the journals which have been published.
I see.
We have peer-reviewed journals published since 1937 of the scientific research. And, well, for instance, one little fact, the dice-throwing experiments, which gave the first information that there might be influence over mind over matter, were summarized and studied in its meta-analysis way, where you can lump apples and oranges and accumulate it all together. And that was summarized by Dean Radin in 1989, before they got into the more modern ways of studying this. And they found the data at that time were 10 to the 96th power. That's 10 with 96 zeros after it. The chances of it occurring by chance, the summary of all that results. That was just the dice throwing. And there's been better research done, more substantial done, for instance, at Princeton, by the Princeton Engineers Anomalies Laboratory, PAIR Laboratory, which is recently closed down, but they did a phenomenal job of investigating psychokinesis with the more modern methods and so forth. That's just one thing. That I could say the same for precognition, telepathy, not as well established as precognition, actually, in the laboratory, but you could add it all up, and it's there for people I'm a believer in science. We have to have this. We have to have it basically under. But most people don't read these facts, and they don't read the data. They just look at the idea and say it can't be true, and therefore they don't go to the research reports.
Right.
Yeah. I have to say just a word about skeptics. I think from a sort of a practical working definition of true skeptic versus a skeptic in the realm of scientism. True skeptic to be someone who just if it's even theoretically possible to evaluate data objectively, you know, without any bias,
right,
and then make a decision based on the hard facts, there have been skeptics who've done that and become convinced that the phenomena are real. Then there are skeptics who basically fall into the realm of debunkers, who have a predetermined set of beliefs that, or I call it scientism, because they just dogmatically defend the status quo, and no amount of data is going to convince them, and they're going to debunk everything in the most manipulative way they can. Mm-hmm. And those folks, I wouldn't call true skeptics who are open-minded. They've already made their decision before they look at the data. So
sure, sure, absolutely. Well, Larry, I wanted to ask you. You, as we mentioned, you're a radiologist by training, and you've talked about how this seems to be centered in the temporal lobe. Have you or anyone in the field ever done any neurological imaging studies connected with these phenomena?
Well, that's a good question. Unfortunately, I'm a musculoskeletal imager, so I'd be focusing on the bones and joints.
There you go.
But rather than the brain, but there is research going on with EEG and neuroimaging, mm-hmm. and I have to say that's all works in progress at this time.
I see. Because I know the studies with yogis got a lot of attention.
Yeah, I mean, probably the most interesting research has been done, you know, by Elmer Green and in the realm of biofeedback, looking at how skilled people can have control over their states of consciousness. And I think it's useful to talk about the different brain waves that can be studied using EEG and looking at beta, which is the frequency we're most commonly in, between 12 and 20 hertz, which is waking consciousness. And then the best correlates with possible psychic functioning would be to have the brainwaves slow down, and through meditative techniques go into the alpha state, mm-hmm. and which is sort of the zone of peak performance, which is between 8 and 12 hertz. And then if you drop down lower into theta, which is 4 to 8 hertz, that seems to be the realm where the left brain is least active and the right brain is more active. And that's the realm of vivid imagery that creative people go to. I imagine a lot of people with ADD go to on a regular basis. And also shamans and other people who work in the psychic realm spend a lot of time in theta. And even Thomas Edison was known to do what Elmer Green describes as interrogating theta. It's like you ask yourself a question, you want the answer. Well, it's probably going to be in theta if you can slow your brain waves low enough to find it. He would ask himself a research question and take a nap with ball bearings, one in each hand. And as he dozed off and his brain waves slowed down into the theta realm, the ball bearings would fall out of his hands and hit on the floor and wake him up, and he would have the answer. There's other ways of doing that, but that's the most clever one I've heard
of.
That's
a good idea.
Yeah, and then, of course, if you let yourself go the whole way to 4 hertz or below, you're into the delta range and you fall asleep. So there's that zone there of creativity mm-hmm. that people can use for this realm.
That's interesting, and people who send me their stories that are in the book, and they still send them every day, their ESP experiences in their own report are very often, it's a dream. In fact, 60% of the reports are, they're aware that they're in a dream state. I would say that a good number of other people who think they're awake are probably in that daydream state, and we maybe sleep states actually go on doing so-called waking hours. Mm-hmm. So that's, we clearly think that's implicated. And they very often report they are meditators. And one of the, when we do the Gonsfeld research, we have people in a relaxation state. So we think this brain state is obviously related. There is a neuroscientist named Michael Persinger in Canada who has done some work in locating temporal lobe, some implication there, and particularly from some of the high-scoring psychics. He has found some indication it's more than just you know, it's more than just a speculation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might be useful to point out here, just since you mentioned dreams and and ESP during sleep, the thinking is that, particularly for left-brain people, the dream state might be the most conducive state to ESP because the left brain sensor or filter is shut down for a period of time, and then the right brain material has more access. I know for me personally, I've had a number of precognitive experiences in dreams, particularly for me regarding tornadoes in North Carolina. And I would have specific dreams of tornadoes, and then within the next week, there'd be a tornado in North Carolina. And we know that they're not all that common in North Carolina, so the odds of having one within a few days of my dream are pretty slim.
Okay.
And that's happened on a number of occasions. It got to the point where if I had a tornado dream, I would be particularly nervous over the next few days. And sure enough, there'd be one in Hillsborough, there'd be one, you know, and it was quite unusual. I haven't had one recently.
So. Good. please give me a call the next time you do have one, especially in Hillsborough, because I live there too. Well, Sally, I would like to read you back another short quote from your book and just get you to kind of elaborate on it for us. You wrote, quote, "Our efforts today no longer focus on whether ESP exists. We have strong evidence that it does. Instead, we are studying how ESP works by examining how personality, emotional relationships, mental and physical states, education, gender, and other variables may affect ESP experiences." Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked a bit already about mental and physical states. What about some of those other variables?
Well, I also should add that we do have now some bioengineers working with us, and they are, Steve Bauman and Bill Joynes are specifically working on a grant, starting up, they're starting to work very soon now, on the bioenergy characteristics of mystics or healers or certain identified people. And they have found some evidence of that, preliminary evidence, that there is something measured that's a new energy form, not within the known spectrum. And they've found that sort of thing especially. So we are interested in the characteristics, physical, emotional, whatever. I'm looking at, I'm collecting stories that people will send me if they feel that something physical happens in their environment that they can't understand or explain and think is related to them. Like when somebody's very, very angry, the picture falls from the wall or glass breaks. Mm-hmm. Or when they're in a very emotional state, the computer, of course, computers break down a lot, so we can't blame them all on that. But
right.
But if we think there's a pattern, and some people do seem that, then we want to look at that and what are their characteristics. We're more concerned about who they are than we are trying to prove at this point what's happening. Those would be experiments that we're doing at our own laboratory. There are several others, a little more complicated. We have one of our colleagues who's in England now who is very much interested in gender issues, and she's going to be writing a book on what we have learned about the difference in how men and women handle or show their psychic ability.
Is there any preliminary data on that? Because I would certainly think that women would be tend to be more sensitive, more related to their emotions.
Well, that's the common belief, and in fact, the letters that come to me, or particularly the letters that came decades ago, came to my mother by postal mail. She started collecting the stories. Right. We have the largest collection in the world, for instance. But predominantly, 70 or 80% of those were from women. I'm not keeping count today, but I would say that there are more men reporting them today, and I think that has more to do with the internet. It's easier to send off a story and while you're at work or something, and more women and men are both working today, so it's not the discrepancy used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the reporting thing. When we look at research itself, the amount of ESP seems to be this, or PK, psychokinesis, seems to be the same for men and women, but it differs. And even in the laboratory, the Pair Laboratory at Princeton, where they started off as engineers saying, hey, we're not going to study psychological variables because we're engineers and we think this could be studied in that way. One of the predominant findings they had is when they finished their 25 years of work was that there were gender differences. And these were often women engineers versus men engineers. Mm-hmm. And they just had different types of patterns, which are too complicated to go into now.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. My guests on Radio In Vivo today are Drs. Sally Rhinefeather and Larry Burke from the Rhine Research Center. Sally or Larry, whoever would like to take this one, is there a holy grail here in terms of the research itself? Of course, in science, nothing is ever seemingly proven beyond all doubt. But is there one particular piece of evidence that you wish you had but don't really have yet?
That's a good question.
I would say that the Holy Grail, I guess I'd refer people to Rupert Sheldrake's website, sheldrake.org. And he likes to do very simple, elegant research that's inexpensive to do. It's often can be automated, and it's usually directed toward common everyday experiences that people recognize as seems to be psychic.
Mm-hmm. Like staring.
Yeah, and there are a couple things on his website you can go to. You can even participate online in some of his experiments. But one is the sense of being stared at, and that's the title of one of his books. And it's like people get this feeling like, oh, someone's looking at me, and they turn around, and sure enough, someone is. Well, he wanted to find out if that was true. And he and other people have done that research numerous times and get very, very high statistical significance, millions to one, that is true. But when you look at more practical evidence, it's like, okay, if that's true that people have this sense and it's true that there's science, how is it used in the everyday world? Well, it turns out that when he investigated further, he said, well, turns out that, private eye school, spy school, that's one of the first things they tell people is when you're tailing someone, don't look at their back or their head. Mm-hmm. Look at their feet.
Okay.
And they
okay.
won't know that you're looking at them.
Wow.
And so it's like there are already practical applications to this information long before the science was ever even done.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think in terms of those kinds of evidence, a lot of the Holy Grail stuff has already been done.
Okay.
In terms of proving that it exists. The other thing that he does is people have the common experience of knowing who's on the other end of the phone before you pick it up. And sure enough, he did research on that. And again, millions to one odds of it being just by chance. And these kind of practical things, and of course the most practical aspect is perhaps the most esoteric in this field, and that's the remote viewing work done by the military, and where you just give people trained remote viewers the longitude and latitude of any place on the planet, and they would draw a picture of what's there at that specific location, and it would conform to the satellite photo that the spy satellites took in of Russian missile sites and other things, and so there you've got. And that's been studied scientifically, but also the practical applications far exceed even our wildest imagination, actually. So,
well, how about you, Sally? Is there, let me ask the same question slightly different way. Is there one particular study or type of study that you would like to conduct if time and money were no object?
I don't know whether to go into what I think the public wants, which is not... What the public wants us to know is, have we got evidence that the mind exists over time and even after bodily death?
Right.
Mm-hmm. That is the basic number one. That would mean more to the whole world. We think what we've got now means a lot in that it does show the connection between people.
Sure.
But people want to know, it's the survival question. Is there a way to know that what mediums purport to be in touch with your departed sister, and it gives you information that only you and your sister would have known.
Mm-hmm.
Is that coming from your sister's spirit that survives after death, or is it coming from your own memory of it, even though it's converted around and sounds like it's coming from the spirit world?
Mm-hmm.
I think this is amazing, an important question. I'm right on the fence myself because I get so many stories that are just mind-boggling of little children talking to to grandma's spirit. They never knew grandma, and they're saying things that they didn't know. But you know, they're just amazing stories like that that come into me all the time. But how can we prove that?
Right,
how can we make, bring this into the scientific realm? That's the biggest challenge that science has in our domain. And I think even the most serious skeptic, everybody's lost somebody they love, you could be very skeptical, but if you thought that were true, you'd wake up right away and start paying attention.
And the big problem is the mediums who were doing this work, you know, and purportedly connecting with the spirit world, they're also very psychic people. So there's no way to really know, are they really in connection with an entity, or are they simply very psychic and reading your mind, or reading some sort of ESP phenomenon. It's almost impossible to differentiate between those two phenomena.
And of course, so, you know, there are a lot of people doing that who are very skilled entertainers and
clearly we have to always be concerned with ruling out sensory cues and fraud. Oddly enough, years ago I used to scoff at, even before I even read the data, I used to scoff at the reincarnation studies. But now that I have read them and heard them and listened to them, I'm thinking, wow, there's an awful lot there done by some very competent researchers from the University of Virginia that, if true, it's really hard to find an alternate explanation for why a little child would seem to know things about another person whose spirit she might have been born with. But again, that it's difficult research. They are just one place in the world that really studies that well. And
That's Ian Stevenson, just died this past year, who was the sort of the grandfather of that line of research. And you know, the papers that are the most impressive are the ones which basically show a child who has a memory of a past life in Tibet or Nepal, where it's commonly culturally appropriate to have those kind of memories.
Sure.
And then the child has a memory of the way they died in the previous life, and they have specifics as to who they were and what village they lived in. And then sort of the clincher from the physical evidence point of view is they have an unusual birthmark. And the one that stands out in my mind is the kid with the splotchy, unusual, hypopigmented birthmark over the sternum, and remembers dying in a flash of light and a loud noise. And when they track the records down of the actual person who they claim to be, it turned out they've been shotgunned in the chest, and the actual autopsy drawings of the wounds were identical to the child's birthmark.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Now, and that was not just one, that was dozens of cases that he was able to find that fit that kind of pattern. So it's hard to come up with an alternative explanation.
That's right. It's on the cutting edge of our work, which in itself is the cutting edge, you might say. We could bring some of these other things into the laboratory where you can get probability figures. Yeah. This other data depends upon careful, you got to trust the people that are doing the work. And that's harder to do, and it's harder to replicate, of course.
Sure. Well, you know, I think even the most skeptical person would certainly admit that we still know very little about the nature of human consciousness.
Absolutely. And as a psychologist, independent of being a parapsychologist, I think it behooves us to help people with answers for their puzzling behavior. You can't believe the amount of grief and distress that people come or bring to us, asking us, am I crazy? I had this inner voice that told me something that came true. Does it mean I'm schizophrenic? Whatever, and so forth. And so there's a lot of need for help for people to understand this behavior. And if people just scoff at it and turn them away and just automatically treat them as odd, fortunately, many of the mental health workers are now becoming more interested and now paying attention. We've had some seminars for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, then let's talk about the investigations you conduct at the Rhine Center of PK, or psychokinesis. Have either of you ever personally witnessed PK at work in some of these investigations?
Well, I've participated in research years ago. I did work in the parapsychology laboratory before I became a clinician.
Right.
And actually, my mother and I did an experiment one time when it was a complicated experiment, but I'll just say the summary of it, we got some results afterwards which seemed to relate to the mood that we were in at the time. I would note my mood, and later we would find a correlation between that, and it was more like an internal correlation. Mm-hmm. But the laboratory psychokinesis is very small and very, it's statistical. So it's very unusual to see it all at one time. Now, you might see a display of ESP experience. I've seen a little girl once guess 24 out of 25 cards correctly.
Wow.
In a little one-room schoolhouse in Minnesota years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me a believer if I hadn't already been. But the psychokinesis is a weaker phenomena. The evidence for it is not as dramatic and not as strong.
Mm-hmm.
And now when we talk about the things like, well, there was a famous Russian woman that practiced and was able, apparently, I've seen the movie, which was able to move objects mentally. And then when there was a glass cage over the object, and you'd see that move. Now, you didn't know the film was made in Russia, you know, and was it faulty and so forth. A lot of attention's been given to that kind of phenomena. But it, again, it's like the reincarnation studies. It's
sure.
hard to study and it's hard to see it. So, but we're still looking.
And there are reports of people who've been able to influence compasses without touching them, and you know, which brings up, well, maybe it's a magnetic field effect of some kind, which is kind of interesting. And then, of course, the whole field of poltergeist phenomena, where large objects move, but that's not generally able to be studied in a controlled environment. Those are spontaneous reports that sometimes are quite dramatic with large objects moving. On a more microscopic level, where other of us might have common experience with it, you can bring up the whole topic of influence on computers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I had one particularly dramatic experience with it in the radiology department at Duke, with a woman who came in back in 2000 into our reading room and said, who's interested in studying healers here at Duke? And I said, well, I'll talk to you about that in a minute, but I got to finish reading these x-rays. So she sat down and watched while we read a few x-rays. And I said, by the way, how do you know you're a healer? She said, well, I guessed all the cards right for Dr. Ryan when I was a little girl. So I had her sit there, and after a few minutes of reading x-rays, I had to get some more information on a particular case I was reading, so I turned back to the computer behind me, sitting next to her, typed the patient's ID number in, which was, you know, a series of numbers and letters. It came up all gibberish on the screen as like the caps lock was on, you know, with all the symbols came up.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the caps lock off, typed it in again, same thing. I did it three more times, nothing. You know, all the same gibberish came up on the screen. Finally, I noticed she was staring intently over my shoulder at the computer screen. I said, are you doing this to my computer? She blushed, jumped up, and ran out of the room, and my computer came back on.
Oh, wow.
The next time I typed it in, perfect. And she came back a few minutes later, and I said, what's going on? She was all soaking wet. She had gone to the bathroom and dumped a cup of water down her blouse, and she said, well, when the energy builds up too much, I have to flush it down.
Wow.
And she said, my friend, guy who works with her, who has similar ability, says, oh, he works with the CIA and the FBI, and they won't let him near any of their computers. So so some people out there listeners may have had that experience of having unusual influence on machines.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And they could write me and send this account. This is part of what we are collecting now.
Sure. Well, you know, that brings to mind work going that's been going on in large measure at Duke for quite a while, that I'm sure that you keep up with, the work with amputees that they're building interfaces to allow amputees to control prostheses through just conscious thought.
Right.
Is there any correlation here? Is that shedding any light on your work, or vice versa?
Well, actually, it ties in a little bit with some of Dean Radin's work a while ago. His holy grail was to develop the psychic switch, where you could walk into a room and, with the right mental intention, turn the lights on and off. And so
you don't even have to clap your hands.
Right. No hand clapping. That gets into whether we have the ability to control our brain states of consciousness, and perhaps the EEG to such a point where it has a meaningful influence on the world around us. And that's interesting work.
Well, and it all speaks to the mind-body connection itself, which I think that there's a little doubt that that certainly exists, and a lot of evidence that it has a huge impact on our lives and existence. Are we coming to see more acceptance of that undeniable existence of a mind-body connection, do you think? And does that influence what you folks are doing?
Well, I think just in the world of medicine, in the integrative medicine realm, Duke has a Center for Integrative Medicine now, and clearly outcomes research is looking at the influence of the mind-body-spirit on health, and I think that's a hot topic these days.
We will actually have a talk on that on August the 17th, Friday night. Dr. Mitchell Krukoff from the VA at Duke University, who has done, he's called euphemistically called the prayer doc. He did famous mantra study, and he's going to summarize that and other work, I guess, that he's doing.
Yeah, and the mantra study was based on his visit to India and meeting the famous avatar Sai Baba, and actually becoming the cardiology consultant for Sai Baba's state-of-the-art high-tech hospital in India. Mm-hmm. And then he realized that the thing that was missing back here at the Duke VA hospital was, well, in India, God made rounds. You know, so Sai Baba would go around and bless people, and he wanted to bring that energy back to the Duke VA hospitals. And sure enough, he designed this project where there were five different possibilities for the patients in who were in the cardiac cath lab, and he's a high-level interventional cardiologist. So these people are coming in with angina and, you know, heart attacks and different types of chest pain, and they would be assigned to one of five groups. One was either be taught imagery, you know, to relaxation states. One would be assigned to a group with healers. One would be assigned to a group of, interesting enough, prayer groups from around the world.
Sure.
Who would pray for that particular patient. Mm-hmm. And then there would be a control group who would be in none of those different categories. And I think there was another group that was that just had music and relaxation. And sure enough, in the initial studies, there was a slight statistical significance, better outcome in the patients who'd had interacted with one of the healers, but the prayer group had done even better. Now, subsequent larger studies didn't show a major significant effect, but those were all published in the cardiology literature, interestingly enough.
So, sure, yeah. Absolutely. Well, again, there's that mind-body connection at work if nothing else, I mean, we know about the placebo effect. Yeah. You're getting something completely inert.
A good example.
And makes you better. Mm-hmm. One thing, we're actually approaching all. Is anyone working to relate all of that to quantum phenomena? Because it seems like looking at the quantum world, there are strange, seemingly physically impossible things that apparently happen routinely at the subatomic level.
Spooky things at a distance is the famous quote.
Right. Is there anyone looking at tying that in with the real-world phenomenon of psi?
Yes, quite a few people really are. And again, I'll come back to Dean Radin's book. He summarizes the theories. He has some education in electrical engineering and his background, too, so in physics. So he's up on that. Actually, there's a Nobel Prize winner, Brian Josephson, who was here at our laboratory several years ago, took part in a Taking a Flight conference that we had, who has done some pretty strong theoretical work in that area. I'm not competent to summarize it, and fortunately we don't have time anyway.
Yeah, and I guess the unfortunate thing in this whole sort of the new age publishing and media field is that almost everybody invokes quantum effects to explain all kinds of things.
Overdone, yeah.
And so that's kind of overused, you know, that, oh, quantum consciousness, et cetera. And then there's a lot of hand-waving that goes on about how quantum physics explains all this. But then, you know, there's really not a lot of solid cause and effect there. So I think, yes, there are some interesting quantum phenomena that could be related to psi phenomena. But I think we have a ways to go until we really understand it.
I would think a long way to go.
Absolutely.
Well, the point being, though, that you know, we've seen that there are, in fact, I think it's pretty well physics proven that there are more dimensions, but perhaps many more.
Yeah.
So there's apparently a lot more going on in our world and in our physical world even than we know about even right now. So it seems as if these phenomena perhaps are manifestations of these things that we're just barely starting to learn anything about.
Right. My dad said many years ago, ESP does really exist. ESP is non-physical. It shows that man can do or be that which is beyond space-time. Now, non-physical was the classical physics of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And now we may have to redefine physics.
Yeah, and then we have a nice quote from Albert Einstein, too, which is, people like us who believe in physics know that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion.
Right. Yeah, well, we have seen that space and time are much more fluid than we ever ever thought, thanks mainly to Einstein himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just in the waning moments here, Larry, I wanted to ask you just very briefly about something else I see that you are also pursuing, intuitive diagnosis. What is that?
Yeah, just briefly, I've worked over the last 15 years with a number of intuitives, medical psychics who can make a medical diagnosis without any technology. And it's, I mean, one of the most popular authors in this area is Carolyn Mace, M-Y-S-S. And I had the opportunity to work with her once 15 years ago, and she was able to make a diagnosis that I had just made on the MRI scan in 5 seconds over the phone from just having the name and the age of the patient. And I was quite shocked. And I've since subsequently found a number of other people who can do the same thing. And I think it opens up a whole realm of possibilities for medical diagnosis. I mean, we spend a lot of money doing MRI scans these days, but it would be interesting if we had someone who could triage the patients as to whether they would actually find anything on that expensive MRI scan if you went ahead and did it, you know. So
maybe we can get the insurance companies to start covering that.
Absolutely.
Good idea.
Well, Sally and Larry, it's been an absolutely fascinating hour, and I want to thank you for taking the time to bring us all up to date on the work you're doing at the Rhine Center, and certainly wish you the best of luck as you continue to pursue the science behind extrasensory phenomena and human consciousness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have got some terrific guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for the lineup, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carborough and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.